Howdy, I am James Mickens, and today I'm going to describe to you Rivet, which is a browser-agnostic tool that allows web developers to debug applications that are running remotely on the unmodified commodity browsers of real end users. So what's the motivation for this project? Well, the motivation is that essentially web development is this miasma of pain and confusion. Okay, why do I say that? Well, first of all, JavaScript is an absolute clown down. Okay, it's got horrible mechanisms for encapsulation. Everything's asynchronous. It's incredibly difficult to see what's going on and how to get it right. Okay, second of all, there are so many browsers out there. Okay, you might test on Chrome, but your users use IE. You might test on IE, but your users use Firefox. So it's just very difficult to get even basic things working across multiple browsers. Third of all, the network hates you. Right? So web pages use the network as their primary content delivery mechanism, but at any given moment, the network can be slow, it can be laggy, it can be down, it can back up again. It's like being in a bad relationship, okay? So this is a very bad scene. And finally, mobile is a hateful adjective, okay? Not only are the form factors totally off for these mobile phones, so getting stuff looking visually nice is very tricky, but these mobile devices also have very poor network connections as well. So the state of the art for debugging web pages is in a pretty sordid state, I would claim. So let me dig down in that a little bit more. So what exactly happens in your application when things go wrong? Well, if you're developing a desktop application, you've got all these rich IDEs like Visual Studio and whatnot. You can do nice things like set breakpoints and explore object properties and things like that. So that's all fine and dandy. Now, if you actually look at all the popular commodity web browsers, they actually have these days very good built-in JavaScript debuggers. Okay, and so you can do things like set breakpoints and look at object properties and things like that. So you might be wondering, well, James, if we have these built-in debuggers on the browsers, why don't they solve the problem that we're looking at today? And so there's a couple problems with these built-in browser debuggers. So first of all, in most cases, they can only examine local bugs, that is to say, bugs that are actually on the local developer's machine. And so this is problematic in terms of bug coverage, right? Because we actually want to be able to look at the bugs that real end users are encountering out in the wild. Now, you may be aware that some variants of the WebKit browser engine do allow remote debugging. So for example, Chrome and Safari support this. However, even these remote debugging tools, they're tied to one browser, right? So I can't actually use, for example, Chrome's remote debugger to debug a page running on IE, let's say. And this is problematic because a lot of the bugs in web pages arise purely from the fact that a particular browser has an idiosyncrasy or quirk that's causing the page to fail on that browser, right, but not on another type of browser. Okay, so what we really want, if we're a web developer, is a browser-agnostic remote debugger for web applications. Right? Now, unfortunately, such a thing doesn't exist. And if you're a web developer, this is sadder than the day they forgot to paint in Charlie Brown's face. Reflect on how sad that picture is for a moment. Just a very deep, this is the poignant part of the talk. Got a cardiologist in the audience. Someone's getting sick. Answer that phone. So, this is the current state of the world. And so here's our solution, okay? It's called Rivet, and it is this browser-agnostic remote debugger for web applications. So what does it look like? So on the left-hand side of the screen, you've got an unmodified user browser. And in this example, it's loaded a web page that has three frames in it, okay? And you can think of each one of these frames as having an event loop that processes keystrokes and mouse events and things like that, AJAX data and whatnot. So what the developer does is that the developer puts our JavaScript library, rivet.js, in each one of these event contexts. And so this library is going to run first, okay? It's going to instrument the runtime in ways I'll describe later, which is going to support the pausing and debugging process, right? We need to pause the page before we can debug it because it needs to be quiescent before we start poking around in the innards. Now what we see on the right-hand side of this diagram is the remote debugging infrastructure. So everything on the right is stuff that lives on the developer side. So the remote debug server acts as the rendezvous point between this paused web application and between the thing that's driving the debugging session on the developer end. Now the thing that's driving that debugging session can either be an interactive debugging console. Think here, this is something that's morally equivalent to Visual Studio. We can actually set the breakpoints and stuff like that. Now note that we can also run automated test scripts, okay? So this might be a situation whereby, think of, it's like Windows error reports, but for web pages. So a problem takes place, we run some very simple test scripts, then the user is off on their way. So this is amazing. So now Charlie Brown has a face, and now he's got this amazing tool that lets you remotely debug web pages. So that's all fine and dandy. You might be thinking to yourself, aha, but what's the technical challenge? After all, this is the Usenix technical conference. Well, suffice it to say, there was a lot of technical strategy that went into getting all this kind of stuff right. And in particular, in this talk, I'm going to focus on four questions. So first, I'm going to focus on what are the mechanics of actually pausing a web page? Because once again, the page has to be quiescent before we can actually start looking at it with the remote debugging infrastructure. Second of all, I'm going to look at how do we interactively traverse these object graphs? Okay, how do we actually do this sort of unbounded state exploration that's very useful when you're trying to debug an application? Third of all, I'm going to show you how Rivet implements breakpoints on unmodified browsers without any innate support from the JavaScript engine itself, right? So you have to use a little bit of trickeration here. And finally, I'm going to describe to you how we make our wide area debugging protocol efficient, right? And this is particularly important if you're trying to debug mobile phones that may not have good network connections. So let's examine this first question. So how do we pause a web page? So a web page can have multiple frames, but first I'm going to describe to you how we pause a single frame. Now, as I mentioned before, each one of these frames has an event loop. And this event loop is going to draw events from a queue as the user generates events by interacting with the page. So for example, the user might hit a key. And the application can attach a key press handler such that when the key event's generated, this is the handler that's going to process that event. Similarly, applications can define handlers for AJAX callbacks, for mouse clicks, so on and so forth. So the way that the browser works is that it's continually pulling stuff from this queue. So it pulls an event from the queue, executes any handler, and then just repeats this. Now, note that if a particular event handler takes a long time, it blocks everything else that's behind it in the queue. Okay? Now, normally this is considered a bad thing, right? Because now the UI is going to lock up and do things like this. So traditionally, web developers have been taught to avoid this technique of very long-running event handlers. Ah, but I have a very deviant imagination. And so as it turns out, this is precisely what you want to pause a web page, right? So let me show you what I mean by that. So imagine in this very contrived example that whenever the user hit a particular key, let's say the D button, that Rivet is going to attach an event handler to that key press, which is going to say, if I detect someone hits that key, I'm going to pause the application. So how does that work? So the browser is in the event loop, and it handles the mouse click event, fires that callback. Then it handles this key press event, calls the Rivet callback. Now what that Rivet callback is going to do is establish a synchronous AJAX connection to the debug server. Now the A in AJAX stands for asynchronous. Right? And it's asynchronous for precisely this reason that I mentioned before, that in general you don't want to pause the event loop. But in our very special case, we do want to pause the event loop. So when we create that synchronous connection to that debug server, what's going to happen? Well, the Rivet callback is going to enter into this iterative protocol with the debug server. It's going to say, hey, give me a debugging command. I'm going to execute that command, I'm going to send the results back to you, and let's do it all again. And so note that any events that are outstanding in that page are going to be blocked until the Rivet callback finishes. Now, once that callback finishes, then the browser can consume everything else, and then life is back to normal. So that's how we pause a single frame. Now, a web page can have multiple frames or multiple web workers, which are kind of like threads, this new HTML5 abstraction. So how do we pause a multi-frame or multi-web worker web page? Well, essentially what we do is we treat that web page as a tree of event context, okay? And so we just need to transmit that pause message through this dissemination tree. So in step one, the pause request comes in at the top. This is either because the user hits a panic button or there's an unexpected exception that was caught or whatever. So the pause request comes in at the top. The parent is then going to take that pause message and send it to all its kids, okay? And this happens recursively. Now, when a leaf node receives that pause message, it's going to establish that synchronous connection with the debug server and then send an acknowledgement back up to its parent, right? So the leaf nodes are now paused. Now, when a parent node receives confirmations from all of its children, it can do the same thing. It can establish that synchronous connection and then pause itself and send the pause ACK back up to its parent. And so when this is all done, when all the contexts are paused, now the web page is quiescent and it's ready to be debugged. So, awesome. Using the power of the Gorgon, I've now taken your page and I've frozen it. So now that it's frozen, what we're going to do is actually inspect the page. We're going to look at all the state inside that page. So how do we do that? Well, we take advantage of JavaScript's very powerful reflection interface. Okay? In JavaScript, all objects are basically just dictionaries, right? So you think of the keys as the property names, and then you think of the values as the actual property values associated with those property names. So that's very nice because we can explore any object just by doing essentially a reflective loop over it. Another sort of quirky feature of JavaScript is that all of the global variables are actually aliased as properties of this predefined window object. So what that means is that we can automatically discover all the global property names simply by enumerating over the properties of the window object. And another nice thing about JavaScript is that functions are first-class objects. So if you call the toString method on a function, you actually get its source code, right? I mean, this is kind of like catching a leprechaun. There's all these very weird things about JavaScript. But luckily, if you have a sort of feverish imagination, you can harness these things for good and not evil. So these are sort of the primitives, if you will, that we're going to use to explore these object graphs. So what does the debug session initialization look like? Well, here I've showed you the paused application, that debug server, and then the developer's IDE, which is currently saying there's no session available to debug. So the application pauses itself, and then it sends a message to the debug server which says, hey, I'm paused. That debug server then contacts the IDE and says, there is a session that is now ready. Now at this point, I'm going to sort of gray out the debug server because after this point, it basically just acts as a dumb forwarder. It doesn't do anything intelligent. So the IDE knows that there's a session ready, and it sends a message over to the paused application which says, give me all the global variables, that top level state. Once again, we can discover that easily simply by reflecting over the properties of the window object. The application sends the values of those global variables back, and now we can imagine you've got a Visual Studio-like sort of object tree that you can look at. And so let's say that the user wants to expand this object X. So the IDE essentially says, hey, Rivet client-side library, can you expand the global variable X? The Rivet client-side library uses reflection to discover the properties of that variable, sends the properties back, and now we've expanded it, and we see that X, of course, has the canonical property name foo in it, which proves that I'm a computer scientist. So that's how that works. So once again, here's that high-level architecture that I showed you from a few slides ago. I just want to point out three additional properties of this architecture. So first of all, note that all the network traffic in the system uses JSON. Okay, so in other words, everything that's sent between Rivet.js on the client side and the debug server, that's JSON, as is all the network communication on the developer side too. And this has several nice properties. So for example, you can imagine that your interactive debugging front end is just a web page, right, which talks AJAX and talks JSON to the debug server. And in fact, that's exactly what we did, right, in our prototype implementation. But long story short, since everything here speaks JSON, it's very easy for you to swap in and out your own particular components, right? So if you actually, you know, have an HCI background, you can make a fancier GUI. You just have to make sure that GUI talks JSON, and you can swap out our interactive debugging console for your own. I also mentioned earlier that we wanted to make this debugging protocol efficient. There's a couple ways that we do that. One way is that we compress messages. So JSON is a text-based protocol, so it's eminently compressible, so we do that. Second of all, we fetch all the object data on demand. So if you remember from that slide I showed you one slide ago, we don't download all the application state at once, right? We show different views. We say, here's an object that's available. If you want to drill down on that, we then go out and get that data for that object on demand, and so on and so forth. And finally, once again, I just want to remind you that although in the previous example, I showed you an example of interactive debugging, if you think about it, most laypeople users don't want to get into sort of a back and forth with some developer over in Silicon Valley, right? This is, you know, not something the proverbial moms and pops of the world want to get engaged in. So we can run these Windows Error Report style automated tests whereby the user maybe hits a panic button, bloop, little box pops up, do you want to send some information to Microsoft or Facebook or whatever? User says yes. We run a very simple test that takes maybe 1 or 2 seconds, then the user is off on their way. Now, how do we support breakpoints? Breakpoints are a key aspect of a debugging experience, but once again, Rivet does not have any support from the JavaScript engine on the end user's machine because we're implementing all this just as regular JavaScript code. So let's say we had this very simple function here, and we wanted to insert a breakpoint where the arrow points. So morally speaking, we want to replace the original function with one that looks like this, that has this new blue code in it. Essentially, that blue code just goes into a loop, and what it does is that it iteratively pulls the debugging command from the remote server, it executes that command, sends the result back, and keeps on doing that until the remote debugger says, hey, there's nothing else left to do. So that's what we want to do at the high level, but how do we actually implement that? So we do it in four steps. So first of all, we create the source code for F prime, basically this stuff down here. So how do we do that? Well, we call F's toString, right? Once again, all JavaScript functions are first class objects. We get the source code, and then we just insert that blue code that I just showed you. Second of all, we use the built-in JavaScript eval function to generate a new JavaScript function object. So now we have an F prime that has our fake debug thing in it, and if it were to be invoked, it would pause the application as we expect. But how do we actually insert that function into the live application? Well, to do that, we want to traverse the heap on the client side and replace all the references to that original function with references to our new one. So how do we do that? Well, once again, don't forget, every object in JavaScript is essentially a dictionary. So what we can do is the moral equivalent of a garbage collection sweep in JavaScript, right? That just blows my mind, right? It's like being in the Matrix. So how does that work? So you've got all the global variables here, right? Once again, we discover those by iterating on the properties of the window object, right? And then we look at all the objects that are reachable from that, right? And then we repeat that process, look at all the objects that are reachable from that, just using regular reflection. So essentially, we do a breadth-first search to the entire object heap, and whenever we find a reference to the old function, we replace it with one to our new one that's patched that has this synthetic breakpoint put in. And then at that point, once we finish that, we just unpause the application, right? The user goes on, interacts with the application as normal, and whenever the user executes code that hits that F prime, our instrumented version, it will just automatically pause the application, right? So we're done. So this is just one example of the kinds of live patching that Rivet can do. We can use live patching to do all kinds of fun things. So we can use live patching to dynamically install a bug fix to a running application. We can actually also use this to create a chat windows between the user and the developer. So this is very useful in the beta testing case, where the person on the other end actually is willing, for whatever reason, to interact in a back and forth with the developer. Well, we can dynamically manipulate the graphical state of the program using this live patching power. Right? So we can implement things like chat windows inside the actual application itself to be debugged. We can also implement stack traces like this. I mean, there's all kinds of tricks you can do. But I'm going to defer you to the paper for more details on that kind of stuff. So now it's judgment day. So I've been talking all this stuff about Rivet. It's going to be amazing. But you're thinking, OK, James, you got to back this stuff up. OK, talk is cheap, right? So now what I'm going to do is show you some evaluation results, which are going to show to you that Rivet is actually quite efficient, even though it is implemented in pure JavaScript, right? Even though we don't actually have any native support from the browser engine itself. Now, here are the Rivet overheads during normal operation. So what I mean by this is that in the cases when the application is not being debugged, Rivet.js is still there in the background, right? And so here we're looking at what happens in the common case where there isn't a problem. Now, I measure performance here in terms of relative slowdowns. So a relative slowdown of 1 means there's no slowdown at all, and then things greater than 1 are bad. And so I have a couple different tests here. Richards and Delta Blue are computationally intensive tests. Everything else is a test of how quickly the browser can fire certain types of events. So set timeout test is how many null timer callbacks can the browser fire. Ajax download is basically how quickly can a program download data from a local host network server. I chose a local host server, because that gets rid of the impact of network delays, right? So it just really focuses on how quickly can these Ajax callbacks fire. The mouse move test is how quickly can the browser fire mouse callbacks, or the user's just going crazy moving the mouse back and forth. And then web worker ping pong. So once again, web workers are sort of the moral equivalent of threads in HTML5 world. And worker ping pong measures how quickly these workers can exchange messages. And so what we see is that in all the cases but one, there's essentially no slowdown that Rivet causes, right? In the web worker ping pong test, we do see slowdowns of about 20%, but that is only because the web worker exchange rate, baseline message rate, is so much higher than the other message rates. So for example, a browser can only support about 50 mouse callbacks per second right now. This is on Firefox and on Safari and on IE, but web workers can exchange something like 16,000 messages per second. So even though Rivet's absolute overheads are small, they're relatively much larger in that web worker case. But luckily for us, real applications do not consist purely of web workers that are constantly ping-ponging each other. So that's actually fine. Now we look at the time to pause an application. Here I give you the time to pause some synthetic applications where I can control the depth and the breadth of that event loop context tree. And so we vary the depth of the tree along the x-axis. Then we look at a couple different branching factors. Long story short, if we look all the way on the right-hand side of the graph, for an unrealistically dense tree that has a depth of 4 and a branching factor of 3, it takes Rivet about 25 milliseconds to pause the page. No big deal, right? The user can't even notice that. Here we actually see the time that's needed to take pause several real applications. So Crazy Flies is a HTML5 demo that uses web workers to do some animations. Pixastic is a image manipulation program. Super Mario, some poor fool ported Super Mario to JavaScript. That person's probably an insane asylum right now. Tiny MCE is a rich text editor. And then the remaining four things are just the home pages of some popular pages. Long story short, once again, in the worst case for Crazy Flies, it takes us less than 25 milliseconds to pause a page. Nobody cares. Now we look at the size of the debugging messages in that interactive debugging protocol that I mentioned to you before, right? So I paused MSNBC, and then I just sort of poked around in the state. And so we see the sequence numbers on the x-axis. Think of this as time, essentially, that progresses forward as we go to the right. We have the message size on a logarithmic scale note on the y-axis. And then we see the size of the debugger request messages, the debugger saying to the page, give me something. And then the application request messages saying, here's what you asked for. And so we see that in almost all cases, the message size is less than 50K, right? And in fact, if you look at the debugger request messages, these are all on average of about 50 bytes. And if we look at the application responses, these are on average about 13K, right? So that's not very big at all. And note that second gray dot at the top, that does seem pretty big. Why is that? That's the initial fetch for the global variables, right? So there's often a ton of global variables in a JavaScript program because the browser defines a ton of them just by default. And so that one message up there is actually pretty big. But besides that, messages are pretty small. Now note that one of the automatic interventions you might think about doing is serializing the DOM tree. Right, DOM tree is sort of the programmatic representation of the HTML structure. And what we show here is the time needed to serialize that DOM tree on the left and the serialized size on the right. Suffice it to say, the generation time is very quick, less than 50 milliseconds. And the size is about 200K on average. Right? Now, in comparison, the average image on the internet is about 200K in size. So this isn't a big deal. So now I'll quickly go through some related work before concluding. As I mentioned earlier in the talk, there are very rich local JavaScript debuggers that commodity browsers have, but most don't have native support for remote debugging. You could add that support using a plugin. Plugins, of course, are grody. We don't want to do that. Users don't want to install those things. And actually, HTML5 is becoming sufficiently popular that many current versions of browsers are thinking about dropping support for plugins. So we don't want to go the plugin route. And as I mentioned before, WebKit engines do support remote debugging, but it only works for WebKit-based browsers. We can't control what browsers users use. And also, you have to have the user configure things like ports and stuff like that. Once again, proverbial moms and pops don't want to configure ports. And there are also some issues here with, are these remote debuggers constrained by the same origin policy? Right? Rivet is, because it's just pure JavaScript. But a lot of these other debuggers allow you to essentially poke around in the total state of the page, which isn't good from privacy perspectives. You may have heard of the mugshot tool. It's essentially a JavaScript logging and replay framework, right? So it's sort of spiritually similar to Rivet in many ways because we don't want to modify the browser at all, right? So it uses some of these tricky introspection ideas. Rivet has a couple advantages over mugshot. First of all, mugshot needs a proxy server that sits in between the developer side and the user side to log things like images. Rivet doesn't need that. Rivet is also actually less fragile in terms of bug exploration because Rivet actually examines bugs on the context of the machine in which they execute, right? Whereas Mugshot has to transfer a bunch of state across the network. What if the developer's browser doesn't have the same plugins that cause the crash as the user, blah, 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 blah. So Rivet has that advantage. And Rivet also performs much less runtime shimming, which if you've ever done anything involving JavaScript, the more shimming you do, just sort of the more chaos you get. So Rivet has that advantage as well. Now note that I just told you all these reasons why Rivet's better than Mugshot. However, I do encourage you to use the Mugshot tool. Why is that? Of course, I wrote the Mugshot tool. And so I would encourage you to cite it. I'd encourage you to cite this. I'd encourage you to cite everything I do. And in fact, I'll be available for the Turing Award out in the hallway after this talk. So in conclusion, web pages used to be very, very simple. right? 5 or 6 years ago, there's a bunch of static images, static text, that's amazing. Now, all our web pages are like directed by Michael Bay, right? So there's all this asynchrony, there's all these events firing off. It is just a horrible state of affairs, right? And so I think the state of the art for debugging web pages is actually quite poor. And so in this talk, I've described to you Rivet, which is a tool that performs browser-agnostic remote debugging of web pages, runs on unmodified browsers, don't have to install any plugins, doesn't require any context proxy like Mugshot does, and it supports both interactive debugging and automated diagnostics. I've showed you some performance results that show you that it has low overhead when there's nothing during the common case where there are no problems, and then when we do diagnostics, it's quite high performance. And I've also showed you that when we do these non-trivial diagnostics, you can get a lot of valuable information, right, with very low network and computational overheads. And so we think that Rivet is a nice advance in state-of-the-art for debugging web pages. And so with that, thank you, and I'd be glad to take any questions.
Jeff Canning, Harvey Mudd College. This is really cool.
Thank you.
A small detail that I don't think you covered is Firefox has this lovely feature that I keep running into that pops up a window after a bit of JavaScript has been running for too long and whines at you and says, do you want to kill this JavaScript? Does that break Rivet? I mean, it must not because you use Firefox.
No, it doesn't. However, the way in which we prevent it from not breaking Rivet can be a little bit technically tricky because you can configure that, like as a user, whether or not you want that pop-up to show up. Now, if that becomes a persistent problem, what you can end up doing is, we can talk about this more offline, but essentially rewrite things like the set timeout API that takes set timeouts from the application and essentially interpose on the browser's event queue mechanism to sort of say, okay, we're only going to run Rivet for in time slices, right? We release that debugging callback. We make the browser think that we've gotten off the CPU, but because we're actually interposing on all the sources from which the application can add these callbacks, we can then just take the loop back again. It's just sick. This is why I tell young people don't get into web development. It's just not good. Just become an artist or something. But I mean, these are the things that you have to do. So I apologize on behalf of the entire web community.
Hi, James. This is pretty cool. Emil Sitt from Hadapt. I was concerned when I saw like the other cool things that you can do with Rivet. I was wondering about security. And I saw in the paper that you know you talk about HTTPS. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, like, what does it look like if someone does like a DNS attack and like, you know, and hits a server with an invalid certificate? Is the user going to see something?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I mean, essentially, we live and die by the same origin policy sword. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to the same extent that, you know, if someone can, you know, mess around with DNS names or subvert HTTPS certificates, that would also sort of hurt us as well, right? You know, the nice thing about this stuff is that, you know, assuming all that stuff works out fine, then you know if you've got some page from CNN, then only computers from the CNN.com domain can actually do all this insanely powerful stuff, like poke around the state and install these live patches and stuff like that. But note that we're not solving, you know, any of the issues that you brought up, and those are all very reasonable issues.
And I guess in some sense, the risk is not that much worse than someone injecting JavaScript in a similar way. So
that's right. So we're not, because we're not modifying the browser in any way, we're just using capabilities that are there already. Right. So that's right.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Hi, Yun Mao from AT&T. This is very cool stuff.
Thanks.
In the early motivation, you mentioned something about mobile devices having bad network connectivity.
Yeah.
And how does Rivet help in that case?
So there's a couple reasons why Rivet is cool for mobile devices. First of all, it's just incredibly difficult to debug web pages on mobile devices to begin with,
right,
because the real estate is so small. And so one nice thing about this is that it allows you to use, you know, your, you know, four-headed 16-monitor workstation to debug stuff, right? Now, when it comes to the poor connectivity of these devices, well, there's a couple ways Rivet helps you. First of all, we did put a lot of effort, as I mentioned, in making the messages small. Right, so we've actually tested this on mobile devices, and even on very poor connections, things seem to be quasi-real time. Sometimes it's slow, like if you expand a variable, but it's actually not that bad. And second of all, for mobile devices too, sometimes what you can do is actually just hook up a direct tether, you know, just hook up a USB or something like that to your developer machine. That's more useful, once again, in the pure developer case. But that's very interesting that I didn't even know that this would be useful for mobile devices until I was talking to some people who worked in our phone division, and they're like, we're dying out there because we don't know what's going on. We're looking at the JavaScript console, but that's not giving us any information. So but the main thing that helps you in the mobile device for the network connectivity thing is the fact that our messages are small.
All right, cool.
Thanks.